Hi, everyone. Welcome to Potluck Food Talks. Today, I'm here with Jonathan Pomerink. He's a well-versed chef that has worked in different countries. And now he's a co-worker of mine at Basque Culinary Center. And I wanted to check on his life track because he's been in some interesting places with different philosophies. Well, first of all, welcome, Jonathan. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to your podcast.
So you've had an incredibly diverse career. Let's start with your roots. How did growing up in New York City influence you, your early relationship with food and cooking?
Living in New York in general, one starts to like normalize certain things. You have so many different cultures and cuisines that you just become kind of, I don't know, numb to it. So it's like growing up around everything, you just try to consume as much as possible. And in my family, it's always about what's the next thing we're going to eat. You know, like every time we're eating something, we're already talking about our next meal, what we're going to be eating. You know, it's something that from a young age, it's always been around. Food's always been a part of every aspect of your life. You know, like you go to somebody's house for a party or whatever, it's just a bunch of food, who brings what. But New York, it's just you get so many influences and you get so many chances to try different types of food from a young age. And it makes you a little bit more, one or two things. It makes you a lot more open towards them, or it makes you completely closed off from wanting to try anything different.
Yeah, like the times I've been in New York City, it's crazy because you can find an amazing place from Haiti.
Yeah.
Or you name it, like Tibet. It doesn't matter. Like I think every single country on earth is well represented with a restaurant in New York City. And you just have to look for it and find it.
And it seems most of the time very authentic. I mean, I didn't leave the United States until I was like 24, almost 25. But it's like living in New York, it kind of feels like you can like visit several different countries all in one city. And it's like, and it's not just the food, you go to like a certain neighborhood and like a certain community of people live there. And it's like everything's in their language, you know, from the grocery stores to the street signs. It's like everything's in that language and it just becomes like a little mini country. And it's kind of mind blowing and you don't notice how lucky or how much variety there is until you move away from that. Because I lived a few years in Florida and it was just like night and day. And also when I moved to Argentina too, it's like being in a place where it's like so many different cultures that have to live together and having the opportunity to try so many different things. When you go somewhere else where things tend to be a little bit more pure in a sense, you kind of start missing those opportunities that you had in the past where you were able to just, I don't know, walk down the street and try certain Chinese food from a certain region in China. Whereas like now you're lucky if you can even find fast food, Chinese fast food.
And how did you start cooking? What was like your first steps or your first restaurant, your first culinary school? I don't know.
So I started out when I was really, really young because my parents were working. So I would cook for like my brothers and my family. With my grandmother. And then later on, I mean, I started liking food a lot. I started getting a lot of weight when I was around being a teenager. So I just enjoyed eating. So it pretty much went from there. Enjoy eating. So if I enjoyed eating, I would have to cook to be able to eat. And then I got into a high school for that had a culinary program. And the culinary program was like a 4-year program. It was a trade school. And there was a restaurant that was connected to the school. So the students would work in the restaurant in your periods, your class periods of the day, depending on what period you were in, you would be doing bakery production for the service or production or mise en place service or cleanup. So it was 4 years of just like doing every aspect front of house, also in back of house, learning the history of, I mean, everything you would learn in normal culinary school, but at a high school level.
Okay. That's super cool. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's not so common. I mean, there's places in the United States that are like that, but it's kind of like, I don't know. It almost seems kind of like when you think about it, a European sense, like an apprenticeship program or something from years and years ago, people would do like start from a young age, learning something and then just work up from there.
How old were you?
I was 14.
Wow. Okay.
13 or 14. So yeah, I was able to absorb a lot. I mean, it became a little repetitive at once, but that's sometimes the best way to learn when you're younger, like repetitive consistency. So it was 4 years and it's, to be honest, I look back on it very fondly because it was actually like I don't know, a pathway to continue on with it, because I actually enjoyed it. It wasn't something I hated, so I was able to continue with it.
So then you've worked in some iconic New York City restaurants like the Modern and 11 in Madison Park. I used to be a book that really influenced me was Setting the Table from Danny Meyer. And both of these restaurants, at least originally 11 Madison Park, were part of Union Square Hospitality Group.
Yeah.
How was it? Did you got any influence in your philosophy on hospitality and food from these places?
I feel like it trickled down to like the employees, but on a day-to-day basis, not as much as you would want it to be, or at least when I was there. I mean, so Setting the Table, I never read. I have it in three different versions. I have it in a hardback, a paperback, and another version. I mean, I had several different versions of Setting the Table. One I got when I finished culinary school in New York that they gave you when you graduated from there. Another one when I was working for Union Square Hospitality. I never read a single page of it.
So the book is actually like a textbook you get at culinary schools or these kind of things.
Yeah, when you graduate, like I had two different classes. So I had like the whole culinary arts part, and then I was also taking another class, another degree with restaurant and hotel management, where I actually learned a lot there. But I was the youngest person. I was like 19 or something like that, and everybody else there was like people that wanted to start their own businesses or people that changed in their careers. So yeah, they gave you the book when you're done with that class, as along with a whole bunch of other books and stuff like that. And the culinary, when you finish that, they gave you LaRousse, which is like the encyclopedia for like cooking and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then I also got it when I was working for Union Square Hospitality Group. To be honest, I was actually at 11 Madison Park when it was still a part of Union Square Hospitality Group. And to be honest, one of the craziest things, one of the funnest things about it was that... So one of the original Shake Shack spots, which is in Madison Square Park, is literally across the street from 11 Madison Park. So I have so many memories of days like when we were so much in the shit or something was happening where we wouldn't be able to do family meal. So we would just make a run over, like an order, and make a run to Shake Shack. But I mean, I've heard so many things, and the classes that I did take for like restaurant hotel management, so much of stuff of like Danny Meyer and people from his company. There was other people like Mark Maynard and a whole bunch of other people that were super influential inside of Union Square Hospitality Group would come and speak to us. So we had speakers all the time, and I'm talking about a class of like 15 people. So it was all very intimate information, and we would give a lot of stuff. We would do tours of different restaurants and bars and stuff like that, part of Union Square Hospitality Group. And then, I mean, I started working there. I wasn't even... To be honest, when I was looking for the jobs and for my externship, I wasn't looking at it because it was Union Square Hospitality Group. I was looking at it because of what they were working, what they were like accomplishing.
Yeah, because these are well-known restaurants, and even from the very beginning, both of them. Well, Modern, as far as I know, is much older, but 11 Madison Park,
yeah,
is from the very beginning was like a big deal, already well-established chef and everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's 11 Madison Park. I will always look back on it fondly, but it was definitely like boot camp.
I can imagine. Yeah.
I'm talking about
French old school boot camp.
Yeah, it is. But it was just boot camp on the level of just like trying to be super, like I'm talking about, this is the 2010, 2011. So, I mean, this was right around when they first started, like blowing up with like 3 Michelin stars, when they were getting 4 stars from New York Times. I'm not even sure what year they were first on the 50s best. I don't remember what year the 50 best came out, but it was just like everything was blowing up. Things were getting so toxic. I mean, it was just getting so to a level of success, but at the same time, things were just like so skewed. Like you start, I don't know. It was just like, it's hard. Like to think back on it right now, I forget that it was a part of Union Square Hospitality Group in this moment. Just because of like, I don't want to say like their goals or their values didn't line up, because in a sense they did, but it was just like, we're working at such a high, at such a level that like hospitality in the back of house wasn't really like, we weren't being hospitable to each other.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like the guest was definitely receiving that, but it's like, we will work super hard. And then like whenever there was partying for any of the accolades we would get, the partying was just ridiculous. Like I have one story that was pretty crazy about the partying that we did when they got the 3 Michelin stars. But I can leave that for later or whatever.
No, go ahead.
So that night, after service was over. So whenever they did any sort of party at 11 Madison Park, it pretty much would be open. I mean, they weren't, I mean, in this moment, what was that? Facebook maybe, in Twitter, but nobody was like posting online, like party at EMP, you know, but like, it would be like, everybody would know when something was won, people in the industry, all the workers there, people that were, that are like previous workers or coworkers or people that you know, the whole place would just fill with celebrities and you would just drink and eat crazy shit all night long. And the thing was, is that morning shift started every day, at least for, well, Pastry, I don't remember, I think it was like 5 o'clock or something like that, but like everybody else that worked the morning shift would come in at 6 a.m. So actually at this point I was already working nighttime, so it didn't bother me much, but basically everybody that had to work morning shift after the night that we had this crazy party, like I have pictures like Daniel Wallude on top of tables and stuff, popping like champagne, magnums of champagne. It was just crazy. He was just soaking people with champagne bottles. Just like these things I think back on it, I'm like that really happened, you know? And it's like that night, everybody that worked AM shift slept in dry storage. So like dry storage was separate, which was actually kind of like its own little torture room, because everybody every single day would have to go in to like dry storage and do relabeling and stuff like that. It was kind of like its own craziness. But the fact is that they all had the whole AM back of the house team had to sleep in dry storage the whole night. But there was also people sleeping in the locker rooms on top of like, I don't know, like old chef coats and stuff like that. People just sleeping in random spots. And it felt like a teenager, like a weekend party, like everybody got fucked up. You know what I mean? Like just random people sleeping in random spots. And the next day, everything was business as usual, but at the same time, everybody was completely, like, destroyed. Like, there was, like, no talking, and it was kind of, like, one of the times where I can think back on it as, like, nobody was being too hard on anybody, because everybody was in the shit. Like, everybody was feeling, like, terrible. It was quiet front of house, back of house. Nobody was yelling at anybody, and it was just, I don't know, I remember that service very well.
So then later your career took you to Argentina and you led some fine dining kitchens over there. Like, how did you end up in Argentina? What were the places you worked? What can you share about that?
Well, I mean, the reason I got to Argentina was because my now wife, but my girlfriend at that time is Argentinian. And she came a few times to the United States for a couple of months. And then there came a point where it was just like, she's not going to be able to finish what she's doing. So I ended up going there, and it was my opportunity to actually leave the United States, because I had never gone before. And I had a passport either until I was like 24. So it was my opportunity to go to Argentina, Kate, that to be honest, I didn't really know much about. I knew some stuff, but I went there on a whim, and I basically just went there in 2015. And that's when like the real stuff started. Like I tried contacting so many places for visas, like work visas and all these types of things. And to be honest, like even, I mean, I was still young, but even with the resume I had, it was just super difficult to get anybody to like take you on, because I mean, it was just, I don't know exactly. Most of the time people were just not knowledgeable of how the visa stuff worked. So I was trying a bunch of different places in Buenos Aires, actually like the main Buenos Aires city. And I wasn't able to get a job. I was like, it was really hard to get a job. I was like, trying to hit all the places that were like higher up, and I wasn't getting, I mean, I had people, for example, Adam Budo, which was like just this year got there for it's the only restaurant in Argentina that has 2 Michelin stars, and they just got it this year.
Yeah.
I had a sit down interview with him when I went there in 2015 and tried getting a job with him. And he was like the interview was in English, which I'm grateful for. And in that moment, I wasn't able to communicate too well in Spanish, but like literally the guy said to me, he's like, we work long hours and we pay very little. That was his
intro.
basically it was kind of like, that's what we do here and I'm not hiring. So then I went to Mar del Plata, and then that's like a 4-hour away beach city. It's like their biggest beach city they have in Argentina, where everybody, the porteños, the people that are from Buenos Aires, go to during the summer. And I just started trying to find places. I was working in what they call a negro, basically undocumented at that point. I had a tourist visa, but I was just trying several different places, working 3 months at a time. And then about a year and a half in, I ended up getting married. So once I got married, that completely paved the way to have paperwork to be able to like have an actual residency and work like legally. And I started working at a friend of my wife. He was leaving as the chef de cuisine, and I got into a place that was like a Nikkei restaurant.
So for people that don't know, Nikkei is a Peruvian-Japanese fusion that started with the migration of Japanese to Peru. And it's quite interesting because basically you will see like sushi with ceviche mayos or these kind of combinations of Peruvian cuisine and Japanese culture.
Yeah, it's kind of like the more elegant or interesting version that Japanese food took. No, internationally, you have like the United States version, the American version, where they add Philadelphia cream cheese to like Japanese food. And then you have what they did in Peru, which is a little bit more refined or interesting.
Yeah, I love that shit, by the way. I was recently in Yacumanca in Barcelona, and I had like a super beautiful Nikkei ceviche, super delicious.
I mean, it's super interesting. To be honest, I was a little bit ignorant before going to the place. And I mean, I found the things that they were doing somewhat interesting. I mean, there was other things that were kind of a little wild, like cooking sweet potatoes in Fanta, for example, for a dish. You know what I mean? Like wild shit that I'd never seen before in my life. Like, I don't know anybody else that ever cooked sweet potatoes in Fanta soda. But I mean, they were doing like ceviche with like hot rocks that we would heat up in the oven, and then serve a ceviche with like a quail egg that we would put on the rock when we serve it. But it was kind of a wild place because it was also sushi as well. And it was just, I don't know. It was kind of like one of those places that was trying to be a little bit more than they could, like trying to be something that they couldn't exactly execute 100%.
Yeah, I know that profile. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the thing is, though, like in Argentina, or at least in Mar del Plata, that's like the MO for like 90% of the places, you know? Yeah, like 90% of the places happen like that. Like people that have money open a place without really knowing the restaurant industry. I mean, it happens everywhere. But in this particular place, which is open to this day, but like the scope of what they're doing changed over the years, but they're still doing sushi stuff. It was just kind of wild. Like I was the chef de cuisine, and the restaurant part, the owner would do all the sushi stuff, like one of the partners, owners. And it was just mismanagement, you know, like, I don't know, discrepancies between the owners. One of the owners would like disappear for like a month and go to Morocco on a trip. And there'd be days that would go by. We didn't even know if we would get paid or if the restaurant would close because there'd be disagreements between the owners. The other owner would play in a band. So like Friday, Saturday nights, he wouldn't even be there. So it'd be like wild Friday, Saturday nights. They would do like Wednesday, all you can eat sushi, with the kitchen open as well. And it was just wild. You know, like when I went in there, I asked the guy too, that was like the chef de cuisine. I'm like, you've been here for less than a year. Like, why are you leaving? And it was just kind of like, no, I want to do something else. You know what I mean? And I was just like, this isn't sitting with me right. But I mean, it was a month after I got my paperwork, I was actually finally able to work. So it was like a step in, you know. I was there for 5 months and then I decided to leave. So then from there, I got into a hotel from a previous customer at the Nikkei restaurant. It was like an Argentinian guy, but he was like a glass manufacturer in Canada. I don't know, but he was Argentinian. I don't understand. There's so many people that I met in Argentina that would just have companies in other countries. So the guy would come to the restaurant once in a while and try to talk to me in English to practice his English. And when I stopped working there, he contacted me and he wanted to contact me for like a private event. And one day he brought me to the five-star hotel in the city there. One of the two or three that are there. Luxury hotel Cosalana. And I went there and he brought me to the food and beverage manager. The food and beverage manager is a French guy. He's like in his 60s. He's been working. He's been making bang, the guy. He's like one of the only French people that are in the food business in Mar del Plata. So like he has lots of experience from many years, but he's been there for 35 years. And this guy brought me there. He just started.
Who is this? Is this the La Borgogna?
No, so La Borgogna is the restaurant. It was, how do I explain this? So like the restaurant, it's kind of like as if, like when Gordon Ramsay, you know, he opens a restaurant, puts his name on it, but it's a little bit more intimate in a sense. Like, so La Borgogna, the restaurant, the chef is Jean-Paul Bondu.
Exactly, because this guy, since I started cooking like over 20 years ago, he was already like the only Argentinian with a Le Chateau or something like that.
Yeah, that's the chef. But he had several restaurants in different countries in Latin America. But the food and beverage manager was also French. So that's where the connection comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So the restaurant came in through the food and beverage manager, but this guy brought me there. He just started lying, like making up stories to the French food and beverage manager. You know, you have no idea how good French food this guy makes. I'm like, I'm working at a Nikkei restaurant. Like, what are you talking about? You don't even know me. And he basically sold me to the food and beverage manager. And I got called in 2 weeks later. And then from there, I just went from like a line cook 1 week. The next week I was a sous chef. And then a month later, I was like becoming the chef of that restaurant, La Bourgogne. And I mean, it went really, really well because like, so Jean-Paul Wondou, yeah, that guy's like in his 70s. He's been in Latin America since like the 70s. Like there's a YouTube channel where it's like Great European Chefs, I think it's called, or it's like a series from like the 80s or something like that. Great European Chefs, where like they'll show you like a French chef and he'll do like 20 minutes of just like his most iconic food. And it's a British series and it's really interesting. Like if you watch it, there's so many different random chefs, some that you really know today and other ones that are kind of like really good gems from like the 70s, 80s, 90s, very like Nouvelle Cuisine.
Okay.
But so he was in one of those he was in one of those episodes.
What year were you in this restaurant?
So that was in from 2017 until 2023, I was there.
Okay. No, because I have a friend who was there, but like, I don't know, I would say 2014, something like that.
In Argentina?
In La Bourgogne, yeah.
Okay, because their main restaurant is in Uruguay, in Punto del Este. And that's where they have like their...
I think he actually was in the Uruguayan restaurant.
Yeah, because that's the one, only one to this day that's still open. Okay. But that's like their main one.
Like the flagship, okay.
Yeah, flagship. That's how I forget English words all the time. Yeah, so then I started working there. I worked like with Jean-Paul, and we would go back and forth. His kids would come as well, which are also in the same industry, his son and daughter. And we would like we would change the menu 4 times a year. We would do certain festivals around certain times of the year. We do certain festivals. And then like maybe 2 years into it, a year and a half, he just started letting me go along with the menu, you know? Before that, it would always be kind of like a thing between all of us, or if his kids wanted to try something out. But then from that point on, it was just me and talking about certain things. And then I just took off from there, you know, like I was just doing my own thing, creating the menu. It was kind of like a weird concept, not a weird concept, but like the hotel, working at a hotel, sometimes they constantly are changing things. You know, they always want to try to like be the best or try something different. So like I would basically be doing 5-course or 6-course tasting menu, changing weekly. And it was just wild because it was me and 2 other people. And that's crazy for a 40, like we can fit 40 people at one sitting, you know what I mean? And for 3 people to do 40 covers, and if half of them are doing tasting menu, 6 courses plus the regular menu, it was just insane. Like it was just, but that was most of my time there. You know, it was wild, but it gave me lots of opportunities to be creative, try different things. It was a really good experience.
Nice. And from then you flew directly to the Basque Country or did you work somewhere else in the South?
So I had to go a little back and forth between United States and Argentina because I had some like family members that were sick. But it was actually interesting because it was a short period in that time period where I was helping a friend that opened a restaurant in Florida. They opened up a Spanish restaurant in Jacksonville, Florida, where there's no Spanish restaurants. And actually helped, like I was there with him after he opened it up like a month after, and I started working. I worked there for like 6 months before coming to Spain.
Okay. And did you work here in Spain in some restaurants or you went directly to BCC?
No, I tried, but I mean, that was a long process for getting my residency here as well.
They didn't like your Argentinian accent. Like, no, you...
Most of the time, yeah. I know, I mean, to be honest, yeah, everybody can tell. And a lot of times I can pass as people think I'm actually Argentinian when I speak Spanish. So
that's very funny. Like an American talking Spanish with Argentinian accent.
Yeah. I mean, everybody laughs when they find out, it catches people off guard because they usually have their guard down. Like I'm talking about, like if I'm speaking with other Argentinians, they have their guard down. And then when they find out or they figure out that I'm actually American or from the United States, they're completely like blown away. And you can see the change on their face. Kind of like you tricked me. And I never said I was Argentinian, you know, like I just spoke to you. That's it.
And how has it been arriving at the Basque Country? I mean, the food here is one of my favorite regions in the world. Like, at least San Sebastian is a city where it's hard to get a bad meal, you know, like the average quality is very high, and there are so many amazing places, like unpretentious bars where you walk in and you have something amazing. Like, what are your impressions?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's hard to get a bad meal. To be honest, before living in Argentina, I didn't really know much about Basque country. I mean, that was like the whole wave that was starting to grow with like Spanish cuisine, you know what I mean? Like in early 2000s, stuff like that. I knew some stuff, you know, but to be honest, I learned a lot about Basque country from living in Argentina simply because so many of the higher, like the more prolific chefs in Argentina, most of them studied or did like internships, or there's a big connection between San Sebastian and Argentina because a lot of them look towards San Sebastian as like a reference point.
Yeah. I stashed at Mugaritz in 2005, and I would say at least half of the stagiaires were Argentinians.
Yeah, they had like their reference point is like Spain, but specifically this region. So I started looking into it mostly because I would hear from people there. And but then my wife was kind of doing some research and decided on San Sebastian because of whatever reasons there were, but gastronomically it would be interesting to me. And to be honest, it's like, I don't even know, like when people ask me to categorize like Basque food, for example, or Basque cuisine and stuff like that, like it's kind of hard to like pigeonhole, you know, it's hard to like categorize it. You can give an explanation, or at least for me up until this point, I'm not able to like give like if someone would be like, what is something they always use?
Yeah, like I do have some, I would say that they never go too crazy with ingredients.
Yeah, they look at you crazy if you have more than four things. They look at you like, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. Bay leaf is already exotic. And not to talk about coriander, forget about it. That's already extraterrestrial, you know, like, and then everything, it's only salt, very produce driven, very respectful towards the produce, and nothing is overcooked. Yeah. Everything is on the right point. Everything is very sensible. Yeah. Also the salt level is low. They're very sensitive towards texture, like gelatinosity, something like they really look forward in sauces and meats and these kind of things. But yeah, as you say, never more than four or five ingredients. I would say those are some of the key features of Basque cuisine.
Yeah. It's just like when you try to like, you can try to categorize something a little bit more like, or define something a lot finer. If, I don't know, like somebody asks you about a certain region of India or China or Thailand or Mexico cuisine, like you can give things, but like when people think of Spanish cuisine, you know what I mean? Like they tend to like have more, I guess more from an American's perspective, like, I don't know, they try to categorize it in a certain way, but then like Basque cuisine is kind of like, doesn't really fall into that same category, or at least what most people would think.
Yeah, it's its own thing. And I would even say that San Sebastian cuisine is its own thing compared and Gipuzkoa, compared to Bilbao and Biscay. That's something different. Both the way of the people and the way of the cooking and eating.
I mean, it's very unique, that's for sure. I mean, it's always interesting too to see how like places that live near the coast, how they differ. You know, like I was living near the coast in Mar del Plata in Argentina, and to be honest with you, like Argentina is meat country 100%. They don't really value fish and seafood for as much as they're surrounded by the ocean. But here it's kind of like, it's normal. It's like integrated mostly into like cuisine and stuff like that. You don't hear like people complain like, I don't like fish, you know, or I don't like seafood. Obviously those people exist, but it's not kind of like, I don't know. It's interesting to contrast the two things.
Now you work as a research chef in a culinary lab. How has the transition been and this change of way of working and cooking? What would you say are the main differences, and what would you tell someone who would like to have a position like that?
I mean, the transition is ongoing, to be honest. Getting into this or seeing the job posting, like I honestly didn't know what I was getting into for as much as it had a description. I just thought it seemed interesting, you know? And I mean, I had like a moment too when I got here, kind of like, what do I want my life to be and like working, like my work life to be? Do I want to get back into that cycle of working long hours, you know, being tired all the time and just working constantly. And I mean, the transition, like I said, it's ongoing. What's nice about it, though, is like, it's basically all the experience that I have up to this point, applying it towards something a little bit more ambiguous, ambiguous, you know, or kind of like, I don't know, something you're using your experience.
At the intellectual level as well, because you're working in a culinary lab because of what's inside your mind, right? Like that's basically
I don't know, you're kind of like simulating things a lot of times too, instead of actually physically doing it. But it's interesting. Like one of the first things too, like I have to like, I'm still trying to like accustom to is like the change in pace, you know, like working at restaurants and stuff like that, you're just expected to constantly be producing and working and constantly all on 120%. Whereas like, I mean, obviously things change throughout the year, but like it's a little bit, the workflow is a little bit different, you know, and you're not necessarily getting that rush constantly, and you're not expecting, you don't see the result as quickly as you would in a restaurant. You know what I mean? Like if you're doing something in a restaurant, it's like you, every time you're always looking like 5 minutes ahead, 2 minutes ahead, you know, you're always looking at things in 30 second bites. Whereas like in this job, you have to like, you have to look at the bigger picture. And then once in a while, like a snapshot of shorter periods, it's just a change in rhythm, perspective. And I don't know, it's just, it's completely different, but it's interesting. And it's a good way to like apply past experience towards something that's actually changes or can change things outside of a restaurant, which is kind of like its own world. You know what I mean? Like this job now, you can actually have more influence over, or more, I guess not influence, it sounds a little too controlling, but you can have more opportunities to change things at a larger scale.
That's it for this week's episode of Potluck Food Talks. If you like what we're doing, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also find us on Instagram and TikTok as Potluck Food Talks. The show airs every Monday.